Hey everyone, and welcome to this special Soapbox edition of the show. My name's Patrick Gray. If you're looking for the regular Risky Business podcast, scroll one episode back in your feed. This isn't the regular weekly show. Soapbox is the wholly sponsored series of podcasts we do here at Risky Biz HQ, where we have long-form discussions with selected sponsors. All about the stuff they're doing, how they're seeing things. It's a pretty open type of thing, hence the name Soapbox. And yes, everyone you hear on the Soapbox podcast paid to be here. And this edition is brought to you by Bug Crowd. And I suppose we used to think of Bug Crowd as, in simple terms, as a company that managed bug bounty programs for enterprise organizations, government departments, that sort of thing. But as you're about to hear, that's kind of an out-of-date way of thinking about Bug Crowd and its contemporaries. These days, they package their services in all sorts of different ways. You've got the traditional bounty stuff, and now you've got products like their so-called next-generation penetration tests, and that's where they assemble a team for you. They assemble a team of hackers from their talent pool who are registered with their platform, and they get them to do more traditional-style pen testing, working through various methodologies, things like that. And then you've got stuff like Bug Crowd for marketplaces, which I think, personally, I really do think is a great idea. Under the Bug Crowd for Marketplaces program, the operators of software marketplaces or app stores can have the apps appearing in their stores tested by the crowd. And, take a look around. Marketplaces are a mess. Look at things like, for the extreme example, look at things like the Android App Store, the Play Store, and browser extensions. It's an absolute disaster. Now, the problems there at that sort of scale, they're going to be hard to address. But what about more niche enterprise stuff? Palo Alto has an app store. So does Splunk. So do many, many, many enterprise IT companies. Well, Bug Crowd has done a deal with Atlassian to test the apps appearing in its app stores. And to me, this makes a lot of sense. If you're a company like Atlassian and, your customer gets owned via a crappy app that they've downloaded via your store, they're still going to blame you for that. And this is a great way for operators of app stores to actually chip away at that problem, both from a risk to the customer point of view and a risk to themselves point of view. And you're going to hear some talk about that in the sort of back half of this interview. So as I say, Bug Crowd is less about straight bug bounties these days and more about what we'd call skills matching. Some years ago, I did a consulting gig for a large company that was basically looking for market opportunities. So I went out and I interviewed a whole bunch of CISOs, and then I wrote like a 7,000-word report for the client. Now, the biggest issue that the CISOs had, the ones that I spoke to anyway, and this was years ago, but I don't think it's changed, one of the biggest problems they had was getting skilled external security people onto the problems that they had quickly. As things were, they'd have to go through complicated RFP processes to do a simple pen test or app test. Consultancies would bait and switch talent. Sometimes there'd be a months-long wait or, schedules would change. So even back then, the idea of some sort of online skills matching service was very appealing to the people that I spoke to. And that seems to be where Casey Ellis, who is the CTO of Bug Crowd, that seems to be the direction he's pushing Bug Crowd in. Casey, do you think that's a fair characterization of where you're headed?
Definitely. And I hark back to another conversation that you're a part of about 7 years ago when you're staying at my joint in San Bruno around RSA when I was pitching you this crazy idea of crowdsourcing being a part of how that's actually going to happen.
Casey's apartment in San Bruno, where the only local food happened to be an amazing taco truck. I have very
which
fond
is still
memories.
There, by the way.
Excellent.
Taqueria Angelica is still very much alive and well. that conversation that we were having back then, it was really this idea of the fact that, seeing vulnerability disclosure and bug bounties and some of the trends that was starting to peak over the hill at that point in time back in 2012, really as a leading indicator of how the security industry actually wanted to do that or how it was prepared to do that. So this idea of, people basically calling bullshit on the consulting model where it's warranted to do that, because there are, I still believe, and there will be for a long time, you know, the appropriate use of people that can sit in a seat and deliver like long-term residual work. But then there's everything else that we're doing, and there's just not enough people to go around. So yeah, that conversation at that point in time, I think that was actually when we were doing mostly pen test work as kind of a POC for the overall business before we got into VDP and Bounty. That was kind of the thesis then. So, you know, really what has happened since, or what happened, I think, shortly after that is the bug bounty and disclosure model kind of got sexy in the market. It became very topical and caught a huge tailwind. So we jumped on to ride that. But really what we've seen over the past, coming up on a year now, is, you know, a return to this core thesis of, okay, disclosure and the ability to connect, you know, the open internet to security teams and to engineering teams is teaching us as BugCrowd the things that we need to be able to do to enable a gig economy and to be able to connect, you know, all sorts of different use cases and all sorts of different people with the demands that exist in the security market. So yeah, I mean, this is really kind of, you know, where we're at, and there's going to be more extensions of that as we go forward, and some of that stuff, you know, we talked about over the past couple of weeks down in Vegas.
Look, it's interesting, right? Because I feel like, as you rightly point out, the whole idea of like connecting security teams to the open internet, putting some vetting around that, that's been really, really valuable, because just handling a security at mailbox is a giant pain in the ass. Like anyone who's ever done that will know, right? Like it's, you're kind of drawing the short straw if you...
As someone who does it for a lot of organizations, yeah, it can be, definitely.
Yeah, so I mean, that's certainly an area where, the bounty providers have provided value. I think one thing we've realized though, and I'm wondering if you're able to concede this, which is that the idea that bug bounty programs were going to scale to infinity, you know, it just sort of hasn't worked out that way. And one thing that's overwhelmingly, you know, the way it's overwhelmingly worked out is that payouts are sort of top heavy, right? Like there's a small clique of very, very skilled people who seem to collect the majority of bounty payments, and they make a really good living out of it. I mean, you've got that long tail delivering some of the lower value stuff, but it does really feel like rewards, findings, all of that belong to a small group of elite people who participate in these bounties. Would you concede that?
I would concede that the number of people that are getting like large kind of top end critical payouts is much smaller than you know, the group of people that's collecting lower and kind of, you know, higher quantity payouts, if that makes sense. I think that has to go to the nature of the bugs themselves. You know, we I hear people sling the crowd as like XSS hunters and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, absolutely not. And it's, absolutely and it's, not. And but it's, the higher value no, stuff, and, it's a small group, right? Like,
well, where I was going with that is that it, you know, the higher value, more critical stuff is either, you know, some random like IDOR or S3 bucket that's been left open, or something that's not technically complicated, but no one's really found it before. So the skill comes into actually looking in places where other people haven't looked. Or you're talking about things where it's a lot more difficult to actually, you know, pop shell. You look at the the Apple thing getting up above $1 million for RCE and the chains for them. Like part of the reason for that is it's hard to do. So it is an interesting kind of balance.
It is. But I thought, you know, for a while there, the hope, right? And, you know, it was my hope as well. And all of the bounty companies, I think, were hoping that what would happen is like we'd see all of these new skilled people sort of emerge out of the woodwork. Then when there was a way to monetize that skill, there was a hope that people would skill up and you would sort of grow that team of elite, you know, bug hunters, right? And that has happened, but maybe not to the scale that everyone was hoping for, right?
Like I get it. And that I completely agree with. I think that's actually, you know, from my perspective, that's actually been more demand constrained than supply constrained, because what we've seen with people that have come in, especially in, you know, technologies as they've kind of hit and started the trend. So like mobile AppSec wasn't really a thing when we kicked off, you know, nor was IoT security. And what we've seen since is people basically take their component skill sets and bring them together and actually learn offensive security on top and take their experience as a builder or as a developer, you know, basically pivot that into you know, being a breaker and actually becoming effective in that way. So we've seen like microcosms or smaller versions of that.
Yeah.
And I think from a supply side standpoint, I still firmly believe that this idea of, you know, really it being more a question of where to look than, you know, do these people exist in the first place? I believe very strongly in that. It just becomes a matter of like, how do you make this model more ubiquitous and more deployable so there's more for them to do? Because the more you are attracting and having these people be active in these programs, you know, at that point, the more you'll encourage others to enter as well.
Yeah. I mean, this is why, though, it gets really interesting when you start looking at the new challenge being that sort of playing that connector role, less so under the previous sort of economic model of a bounty, which is you put money in a pool, and more about like, hey, we've got these people on our platform and you can directly engage these people through our platform, right? So it's almost like, you know, just a tweak of the economic incentive on the model, right? But it's still, you know, you're still just trying to be an alternative way to connect resources to tasks.
Well, at that point, it's on us. So, you know, one of the things that we talked about a ton down in Vegas is, you know, really the work that we're doing around exactly what you're talking about, skills matching. So the idea of Crowd Match, which is how we branded it, it's basically what we use to help customers distill their requirements for a particular thing down to, you know, essentially searches. Like, how do you break apart a narrative or an SOW or whatever else it might be into things that we can actually use effectively to go into the other side of it, which is Crowd Graph, which is the data set that we have on the community to be able to create those matches as quickly as possible and as effectively as possible for both sides. Because as a researcher, you want to be invited to stuff that you've got a reasonable chance of being successful at, and to do that with a good ROI. And for the customer, they want to be able to see that happen in terms of the matches that we make. So like that's the expertise that we build and that we've continued to build in the middle to make that whole thing more effective and more efficient. And, you know, part of what we were talking about down in Vegas was like what we've done in terms of the last iteration or the most recent iterations of our efforts there. I think, you know, ultimately it ends up looking a little bit more like Match.com than anything
thing,
else.
Right?
Like it's literally almost like a dating website for hackers is what you end up building on that side of things, because it's you can't like to a complete certainty say that this person will find a vulnerability of this nature within this target, because if you knew it was there in the first place, you wouldn't be asking the question in the first place, right?
Yeah.
Like the whole thing's based around like if it's there, we want to find it. So in that particular use case where people are getting rewarded for what they find, it becomes about, you know, us using all of the data that we've gathered over the years to you know basically quantify what constitutes an effective match, and then trying to, you know, improve on that and iterate and learn from it and so on moving forward.
It's funny, right? Because, you know, that work that I referenced in the intro that I did back in the day, I said that they needed something like the reverse of a job site. Instead of advertising the jobs, you know, advertise the people, advertise their availability, have their calendars of availability showing on the website.
Yeah.
Like that's kind of the idea there. Like is that, I mean, it feels like you're pushing more in that direction, but it's instead of it just being advertised the supply, you know, really try to match the supply to the demand, you know, work both sides of that arrangement.
I think there's a lot, I mean, there's a lot of different dimensions to how we make a match, and there's dimensions that we're continuing to add. Like I think the things that people think about most regularly is stuff like, you know, is this a web hacker or an API hacker or a, you know, infrastructure hacker, whatever else. You know, it begs the question, what do those terms even mean? It's almost like, you know, the difference between like a, you know, rock, pop and jazz versus when you sort of dig down into it a little bit, like does this have a saxophone in it or does it have a, you know, female lead vocalist or whatever else? Because those are the things that are going to connect more directly to, you know, in the music example, like what the listener's wanting to listen to. Or in this example, like the technology platform, you know, the kind of, the kind of impacts they're most interested in, like is this, for example, a payment gateway? And if you understand at a deep level exploitation of payment gateways and the types of things that go into that, then you're probably a better fit to create the output that this particular client wants, and you'll get rewarded more for doing that. So it's all of that stuff from a behavioral standpoint. But then even, you know, to your point, like what time do they get out of bed in the morning? Like what's the average cost of activation for this individual? Like how much are they wanting to make in a year? Is this even going to be of interest to them, or do we need to gate things higher or lower depending on, you know, what their lifestyle choices are, stuff
like
that.
Well, okay, so this is the interesting thing, right? Like I had a catch up with a mutual friend of ours recently. You know, he works for a large vendor, and he said, you know, he used your vulnerability rating taxonomy internally, and they sprung up an internal bug bounty. with, you know, proper cash payments and stuff, and they used the VRT and it was, you know, it worked really well for them.
Great.
Interestingly enough, though, like what you're talking about there, it sounds like you need a new taxonomy for hacker skills. Hacker skills, motivations, and lifestyle, right? So you almost need like a hacker taxonomy.
Yeah, and there's elements of that, obviously, as we go further into the rabbit hole that are proprietary, but the things that we publish are starting to look a lot like that.
Oh, I don't need, it doesn't need to be externally facing. I mean, it's just, this is how you're breaking it down, it sounds like.
Totally. Like in terms of how we're thinking about it, you know, what is the you know, sort of hacker IQ, for want of a better way of putting it, of an individual? Is this someone who, you know, to your point earlier, is capable of those really high impact issues, you know, for whom like the QA component and the engineering component of offensive security is more transparent, and they're just an evil genius that can get shit done, right?
Yeah.
Or down the other end, you've got people that are very focused on, you know, the symptom identification kind of QA style of testing, which are the folks that generally turn out like the XSS and some of the less critical but more plentiful issues. But the thing that's interesting and I think a bit special about them is that they'll go and find it in places that no one else thought to look. So you've got all of these different kind of variations, not just of the skills that go into how someone does what they do, but also how they apply them based on their own creativity and their own kind of mental wiring.
So what's the work that you're actually bidding for, right? Say I'm a CISO and you're going to give me your best elevator pitch on the problems that I have that you're going to solve, right? What problems are you going to solve for me under this new model?
Well, so this is what we're talking about now is the, call it the foundations of the products that we're building on top, or that we have built on top and will continue to build on top. So that's teasing out some of the.
Yeah, because to this point in this conversation, it's been a philosophical discussion, right? Let's have the commercial discussion now.
So specifically, you know, public VDP and public bug bounty, it doesn't apply in the introduction case, because both of those are open to everyone who's involved. If you're talking about a private bug bounty program, that's when we'll match. If you're talking about private NGPT or even private NGPT when there's, you know, different trust requirements or you know, the need to actually dig into the languages that have been used to create the component systems or applications or whatever else, that's when this really becomes very powerful. And we actually saw that in some of the announcement stuff we did with the Air Force that came out midweek during Vegas as well. And then, you know, retesting is something that we're doing a lot more of now. So basically following through, you know, getting information back from, you know, ours or even other people's engagements where they've got a list of vulnerabilities that need to be, you know, verified or retested, connecting those vulnerabilities to the people that have the appropriate skill set to understand what they mean in the first place, but also understand the environments that they're testing against, gets a much better output out of the whole engagement. And again, it's more, you know, the return on investment for both sides ends up better. Like the hacker's getting introduced to something that they can do well, and the customer's getting a quicker answer.
I can imagine that, you know, M&As would be, you know, I'm just putting on my pretend CISO hat, and I'm thinking, you know, if I'm CISO for an organization that's just acquired or merged with some other company, they got a whole bunch of legacy infrastructure that my, you know, internal teams don't really understand. I imagine, you know, going with BugCrowd on something like an initial quick and dirty assessment would be a very quick and effective way to get it done.
Yeah.
And again, quickly, right? Because that was another thing CISOs were complaining about. They were saying, you know, we're trying to book our favorite testers. Yeah, it's going to take 6 months, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the beauty of that, so this actually goes into the second pillar of what we're talking about in Vegas, like the whole idea of basically workforce automation. You know, okay, we've been able to get you better people. Like, how can we get it to the point where you can connect to them more easily? You know, one of the big things we've done there is basically instantiated, you know, programmatic onboarding for different types of testing that we're able to do through the platform, so that people can actually go through and self-provision. And you know, part of the goal of that is exactly as you're saying, like the sun's always up somewhere. So we can actually provision these things and get them running very quickly. And you know, especially when it's compared to a 2-month wait list for the principal consultant of your local favorite firm, if that makes sense. So we're trying to bring a delta into that as well.
I can imagine that a test, like we should point out too, that when you say NGPT, that's what you guys call next generation pen test, right?
So correct,
just to clear that up for listeners who might've thought, what is an NGPT? What's he talking
Thank
about?
Thank you for that. Yeah,
no problem. I know how we all get with our internal lingo. Right?
We get acronym blind pretty easily, I'm sure.
Yeah. So, I can certainly understand that, when you're putting together a test, right, if you're going to be going for these skilled resources, and I understand you're doing a few things at the moment to bring more skilled resources onto the platform as well, right?
Yep.
Now, those resources come with, professional grade price tags, right? So I'd imagine that the key advantage here is it's going to be quicker, right? So that's one of your absolute key advantages here. I'd imagine it would be a little bit cheaper, but not ridiculously cheaper. What can you tell me about what an NGPT costs relative to a penetration test booked through a regular consultancy?
We've structured it to look a lot like the kind of pricing that people are experiencing right now. So it's basically meant to fit into parity with the market for project-based engagements. And then obviously we can deliver it on a continuous basis as well because of the crowdsourcing component. So yeah, there's a subscription version as well. But the way I would probably think about it is that it's not so much that it's cheaper; it's more that the cost is more directly tied to the output. So with NGPT, what we do is we have part of the portion that's set aside for vulnerability payouts or for engagement of the crowd being paid to people who are actually working per task to complete a list of methodologies to be able to satisfy compliance requirements and get coverage and do things like that. So that's the part that's gonna give you as a customer the assurance and the confidence that everything's been looked at. But what we've also got alongside that is this group of people that are incentivized to basically not do that. Like they go in looking for the shiny thing that they think they can exploit, and they have the more, call it traditional bug bounty incentive in play to incentivize them to create as much impact as they can, but also to be the first to the issues that they identify. So what you end up with is this, ability to say, okay, I've looked over everything that I'm meant to look at. That's been done well because, we're running it through traffic control, and there's the ability to basically see everything that the testers are doing and create coverage reports from a technical standpoint and all of that. So all of that's, the boxes are ticked over there. But then you've also got this group that's actually going in and hunting under the same kind of competitive and, go deep, not wide model that bug bounties have.
Oh, we should point out too that, traffic control is the means through which bug crowd funnels testers through a single connection, almost like a VPN, right?
Traffic control, it's intent. It's exactly as you say, it's infrastructure that we can route the researchers through to be able to do testing. It gives us access, visibility, and control over the entire process. So it gives the researchers access to things that might not be available to the public internet. And one of the things that we've started basically going out to market with is the ability to terminate traffic control site to site to do internal testing and those sorts of things. Visibility is what we just talked about. And that's good from a coverage reporting standpoint, but it's also good, I think, for the sake of comfort, frankly. Like the whole idea of outsourced or crowdsourced people doing this work is still something that people are trying to get comfortable with in various places. So the idea that they can actually look in and see what's going on is helpful for that. And it is a literal and legitimate, IR and kind of forensics capability, for folks if they're concerned about going down that particular route. And then on the access side, the control side, that's the ability to basically stop testing technically if that's required. And that's that has to do with testing against targets that they start to flake out, or there's a change window, or there's any of the sorts of things that you could think of that cause reason for a pen test to be paused. It's basically the same functionality but for the crowd.
Okay, so just going back to the composition of an NGPT, that makes sense. You've got the sort of professionally applied methodologies, compliance ticks all over everything. That works out really well. And you've still kept that bounty component because that gives you a little bit of that canned lightning, if you will.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yep.
One thing I wanted to get your thoughts on, Casey, is one of your competitors recently caused a bit of a stir when they tried to get CREST certification, right? Oh, I think they actually managed to get CREST certification. And This, of course, really annoyed a whole bunch of the consultancies who pay good money to Crest for their certifications, and they see these new companies like yours as trying to encroach on their market without necessarily having to pay, you know, the same level of certification fees and blah, 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 blah. I did think it was interesting that they protested so much. It tells me that they're perhaps a little bit worried that eventually companies like BugCrowd and its competitors could make a bit of an impact in consulting. But then I speak to people like you and you say, oh no, we're best friends with these consultancies and we're actually partnering on some stuff. So what's the most accurate way you can describe this relationship between consulting firms and the bounty platforms?
Yeah, relationship status, it's complicated.
Yeah.
It's probably the most simple way I could put it. Because, you know, honestly, both scenarios are true. There's conversations that even we've had with consultancies where, yeah, there's kind of the fairly adamant declarations of superiority and all sorts of things that kind of get thrown back at our model, regardless of whether or not it's true. And that can come from really good firms that, you know, frankly, I believe are in a position where they can try to say stuff like that. But it also comes from a lot of firms that, you know, probably aren't. And they're the ones that actually tend to protest more loudly.
Yeah.
You know, on the flip side of it, like we announced a partnership with IOActive. We announced a partnership with another firm that does basically IoT ODM testing called VVDN. And we're pursuing more of those because, you know, as I think I've said on the show a couple of times now, like this idea of the crowd coming in and doing what the crowd is best at doing, which is really, you know, kind of coming in from the outside and being in a position where there's logistical access to the target, there's skills and the ability to connect to either a large group of people that can compete or a really rare set of skills that you're having difficulty finding. Like, that's great. That's stuff that we'll continue to expand the application of the crowd into. But then there's the things that, you know, the crowd isn't as necessarily suited to, like sitting on a chair for 12 months at a company and actually helping people, you know, create an SDLC plan or do those kinds of things that consulting is ultimately meant to be, you know, in my mind, actually designed for. And that's where these partnerships come in. Like, if there's things where there is a consulting capability of an organization that actually marries really nicely with the crowd, then we'll go out and try to pursue that. And ultimately, you know, the conversations that we have that are constructive are the ones where they see what we're doing really as augmentation to what they're trying to build as a core business. As a part of that, yeah, are they giving, you know, parts of what they have been doing previously over to the crowd and we're taking that? In most cases, absolutely, yes, they are. But that's freeing them up to do more of the things that they have as competencies.
See, this is the thing, right? I can really see that for a smaller, very highly specialized consultancy with very skilled testers, right? You tend to have these two different types, right? You've got the really, really, you've got the rubbish shops, right? Let's just forget about them for now,
yep,
right?
Sure. Yeah.
But then you've got the really, really big ones, right, who can handle the scale. And then you've got the really, really small ones where everyone's amazing.
They
can't actually handle the scale. And I could really imagine that for some of those smaller shops, right, like there's work that they can't really bid on because of the scale. Whereas if they've got a relationship with an organization like yours, they can come in and say, look, here's our proposal. We propose that we handle these core apps and then oversee, you know, a whole bunch of NGPT stuff through BugCrowd. And, you know, we bill you to manage that. And I just... Is much of that happening? Because I don't hear about that, but I can imagine that just for the scale argument, that could work out really well.
Yeah, no, for sure. It is happening. I think the boutique version is the one that's more common and frankly has been, you know, less complicated. Going back to the relationship status question before. I think what we're seeing and what's actually starting to happen in the market now with the larger organizations is, you know, them looking to us to actually provide their scale. So, okay, cool. We've got this, you know, scaled business model. We've got, you know, this huge like set of customers and traction and all of those sorts of things. Like, how can we, you know, lean into this as a market opportunity more? And to be able to actually focus the people that we have, you know, as full-time employees or, you know, retained contractors within the business itself onto the direction that we want to take the company, And then what can we do about the rest of it? And that's where we end up kind of fitting in together. So I think those conversations tend to be more, frankly, like longer to have. And they're the ones, as I said before, where there tends to be a lot of screeches of protest fairly early on in the piece, because oftentimes you've got, you know, a lot of outsourcing and a lot of different things that are happening within those larger organizations in such a way that their margin structures and all of those kinds of things make this a pretty unattractive business to let someone like us come in and actually take. But at the same time, I think they can see the writing on the wall in terms of the direction that the market's going around its expectations of output and how it thinks this stuff should really be costed out and actually delivered over time. So, you know, it is starting to happen. There's we've done, you know, we're basically at the point where we have partnerships in place of that nature now. They're ones where, you know, they're early, they're inked, and they haven't been announced yet. But, you know, keep an eye on that space and you'll see more over the next quarter or two.
One thing that occurs to me, right, is that, like, I just did it then. I'm like, well, let's just ignore the rubbish shops. But there are so many rubbish shops, and this is a conversation.
There are a lot of rubbish shops.
Yeah, and when you and me, because, you know, we catch up, we're friends, we shoot the breeze every now and then outside of, you know, risky business interviews. And, you know, when we talk, it's quite often like, you know, I'm always interested in talking about, like, you know, how are you going to compete with NCC, right? Like, that's the question that I have. Whereas really, there's so much rubbish work going on that Bugcrowd's stuff just slays. And I think that's a, you know, I mean, that really is a part of the market that you're just trying to take over, right? Is just get people up to a certain minimum requirement. Like, you must be this high to enter. Because there's so much, yeah, there's a lot of bad work out there, right? And you're definitely able to stomp on that.
I completely agree. I think, you know, the funny thing about that is that, and this has been a consistent theme, you know, that was actually the original, like one of the original kind of fires under my feet to get the thing started in the first place, is seeing the rubbish firms and seeing, you know, even the larger firms taking pretty extreme liberties with the amount of supply demand imbalance that exists in the market right now, and really no one kind of walking away from that unhappy. And it's like, this is bullshit. Like, someone needs to actually improve the state of this whole thing to make sure that the user ends up safer, because ultimately that's kind of why we should be doing any of this stuff in the first place, right? And the idea was to, you know, actually go after those, call it rubbish firms, and then work our way from the bottom up. What we very quickly realized, and this is, I'm talking like 3 months into starting the company, was the depth and the awareness of this kind of pain from the top down. So like the enterprises who are having the same issues with their large consultancies, you know, they're having the same issues with their own internal teams. Sometimes they're, you know, potentially hiring some of the rubbish pen testers or pen test companies themselves because of, you know, the timing stuff that we were talking about before, or whatever the reason might be. So we've actually been kind of pulled up into that end of the market, and we're working actually top down as opposed to bottom up, as the original kind of napkin plan was, so to speak. So really what I think it comes down to is our ability to break apart the chunks of work that we're doing for different organizations into pieces where it actually doesn't really matter the size of the organization. And we are working towards that. I think that's one of those things where, you know, we're going to cater towards the enterprise and the mid-market first. But I'm continuously, you know, working towards finding ways to be able to break this thing apart even more, to be able to address the smaller and the broader ends of the market.
Now, look, you were recently on one of our weekly episodes in a sponsored slot, and you were talking about Bugcrowd for marketplaces where, you know, a lot of these organizations that might have apps that they, you know, they have an app store, right? And that could be for enterprise software, everything from, you know, I think the examples I used was, you know, Palo Alto Networks, you know, Splunk, they all have apps where third parties can contribute these apps. But, you know, it's enough to make you nervous, isn't it, when you're running a store like that, that you don't really, if you don't really have any formalized QA on the stuff that's going into your store and that stuff turns out to be horrible, then that makes you look bad. Now, it wasn't announced at the time, but now we can reveal that the organization that you inked a deal with to do, you know, to build bug bounty programs and testing into their pipeline for admission into their app store was Atlassian.
Correct. Yeah, I feel like this is the point where we say Aussie.
Exactly right.
No, it was Atlassian, and they've been an absolute pleasure to work with on it. You know, we've done bug bashes with them, one just recently, and they've been a long term customer of the bounty and the VDP stuff. And we got to talking about this whole issue of third-party application risk and pretty much exactly what you were just saying. It's like, okay, you've got all of this code coming in from vendors that you functionally don't control, like they're legally and like corporately separate from your organization, but you know their performance when it comes to security in their products like ultimately affects the security of your users and also like affects your security and reputation as the mothership and the owner of the marketplace itself. So it's like, all right, well, how do we resolve that? How do we, you know, going, I think back to the M&A example you were using before, it's a similar sort of principle where it's just being able to deploy the crowd at scale to be able to address this type of issue across a, you know, pretty diverse range of different organizations and targets. I think the other end of this marketplace problem, by the way, that you were talking about before is that you know, for the better part, people are consuming these third-party applications without really thinking about the risk. In a lot of cases, and that extends all the way up to, I think, the largest enterprise, you know, all the way down to the smallest startup or organization. So the ability to say, okay, as you know, an app provider in one of these marketplaces, you've actually got something that differentiates you from a risk standpoint, and you know, puts you ahead of, you know, other competing products that might exist within the same marketplace or whatever else. You know, that is a competitive differentiator for the people that actually opt in, but it's also something that reinforces to the user of the marketplace that security of these apps is something that they should be thinking about as well. So there's a win-win there, I think.
I mean, I can't think of another way to do this, right? Like, and that's the first time, I think, through all of these offerings that companies like BugCrowd come out, right? Like, it's always been an alternative too, right? How else would you do this? Like, unless you were prepared to dump truck money towards a consulting firm, right? Like,
yeah, no, totally. Well, and when you think about it, it's one of these, you know, it's one of these things where like the symmetry of the model lines up really nicely. Like in this case, you've got a crowd of different app developers building stuff and deploying it out into this marketplace. And, you know, how are you going to scale to be able to do security assurance and testing on that stuff? Like, okay, a crowd of folks that can come in and help with that. It's less of a gimmick and more just a kind of a logical, kind of symmetrical approach to the problem.
100%. Well, Casey Ellis, thank you so much for joining us on Soapbox to tell us what's happening in the world of bounties, which I guess, you know, bounty companies, I guess we're going to have to start calling them distributed work platforms or something. I mean, there's the old Uber for pen testing joke, but I don't think that even applies anymore. It's been a really interesting catch up, and I'll be talking to you soon.
Thanks, Pat.
That was Casey Ellis there of BugCrowd. Big thanks to him for that. And huge thanks to BugCrowd for being a long-term supporter of Risky Business. And that is it for this edition of the Soapbox Podcast. I'll be back next week with a regular weekly show. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.